when I was putting this panel together, I actually reached out to staffers and asked for the congressmen themselves to come. And you can imagine I was, at first, a little bit disappointed. They said, no, we're going to send staffers out instead. And, you know, after thinking about it, it didn't take me long to realize that this is actually really good, because I don't know exactly how much work the congressmen actually did in drafting this legislation, how much they thought about it, and, you know, how much they did besides put their name behind it. And as lawyers, or future lawyers, we've got two lawyers that are actually involved in the legislative process that I'm sure are going to be able to answer a lot of your questions regarding race and law. On my left is Kenan Keller. He's the senior Democratic counsel for the House Judiciary Committee, where he works closely with Congressman John Conyers and Jerry Nadler. He drafts and analyzes legislation on a range of issues, including civil rights, immigration, intellectual property, criminal, and constitutional law questions, both for the subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties, and the full Judiciary Committee. The reason I asked Kenan to come today is because he's responsible for House Resolution 40, which is the first piece of legislation on the handout I sent out to you. House Resolution 40 was introduced in the wake of the tiramisu, am I saying that correctly, case in which reparations were granted to Japanese Americans who were interred during World War II. Congressman Conyers thought it would be a good idea to at least set up a commission to see what the impact of slavery and its hangover has been, and to study the question of reparations for African Americans. It's been introduced in every Congress, and it's not passed yet. On my right, James Park. James Park is legislative counsel to Congressman Steve Cohn. Steve Cohn introduced the first successful apology for slavery in the United States House of Representatives. That was passed last year to, I still don't understand this, very little fanfare. It wasn't even mentioned in the New York Times. To me, it was a historic piece of legislation, and I'm just not quite clear still today why it wasn't celebrated more than it was, and I hope Mr. Park can help us answer these questions. So, the way this is going to work, I'm going to take about 40 minutes. I've got a few questions that I've already shared with Mr. Keller and Mr. Park. And the last 20 minutes we'll reserve for questions from y'all. So the first question I had was, can you each describe your respectful legislation's history? How did it come to pass that you were tasked with it? Process highlights, in the case of the apology, why was it successful? And in the case of H.R. 40, why do you think it's run into so much trouble? And I'll let you two paper, rock, scissors to figure out who goes first.
With respect to the apology, my boss had written a letter to President Clinton back in 1997 when he was a state senator. And he had, around that time, President Clinton had made some public statements about calling for a national dialogue on race relations. And so, in light of that, my boss sent him a letter.
Can you speak up a little louder?
I'm sorry. In light of that, my boss sent a letter to him asking him to issue an apology for slavery and for Jim Crow, saying that Jim Crow is sort of the noxious legacy of a noxious institution, slavery. He never heard back from President Clinton, and he kept pressing as a state senator to do it on a national level. once he was elected to Congress, it was sort of a confluence of two different things. First, obviously, now that he's in the House of Representatives, the U.S. House of Representatives, he decided, well, now I can actually do something about it instead of just asking someone else to do something about it. So that was his main impetus. Also, right around that time, as we were preparing to introduce our slavery resolution, Virginia passed a state apology, or statement of regret, I guess. They avoided the word apology, but mostly it was an apology for its role in slavery. And so it just seemed like you know, it's a combination of him now finally having his chance to do it as a member of Congress and sort of this movement in what seemed like movement in the states to go down that same road. And so that was the impetus behind introducing it. This was in February of 2007. It passed in July of 2008, so it took a while. And I don't know if you know, to get into that or not, but that was the impetus behind it.
Mr. Conyers introduced H.R. 40 for the first time in 1988. One of the important things about H.R. 40 that we all kind of have to go back to is that H.R. 40 is a study bill. It's a bill that requires the creation of a commission to study the effects of slavery and Jim Crow institutions on the past and present for African Americans and for the United States. H.R. 40 was a landmark piece of legislation in lots of different ways because the chairman wanted to go back and do exactly the same thing that had been done for Japanese Americans. And there was a similar movement that was spawned for Italian Americans and for German Americans who were also detained during the World War II era. The interesting thing about H.R. 40 is that it seems like it's a far-fetched idea. The 40 goes back to 40 acres and a mule, which was one of the field orders from General Sherman as he moved across the South. And every year, the Speaker sets aside the resolution number H.R. 40 for this piece of legislation as a commemoration. One of the other things that the chairman focused on when he introduced this bill was even though the idea that this was a idea that was on the frontier, let's say, of legislation and of race relations, he looked upon this legislation as the kind of legislation that gets passed as part of a long-term effort to move the idea and the intelligence and the social frontier of the country from point A to point B to point whatever. He remembered that in the wake of Martin Luther King's assassination, he immediately introduced a bill to create the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. At the time, that was a far-fetched notion because at that time, Reverend King was still remembered as being a rabble-rouser, as being anti-war, and had his reputation attacked by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. But after that legislation was ultimately passed, the chairman said, well, now I can move on to another large piece of social movement legislation. Because the thing that he said was, look, by the time the Martin Luther King holiday bill became a law, everybody walked up to him and said, John, I can't believe this took so long to pass. When all of these people were standing, you know, in the way of passing the thing in the first place. And so those who were most recently converted had this, you know, very strong reaction. Some of the same kinds of things have gone on around H.R. 40. There has been a grassroots movement through legislatures, through county councils, through city councils across the country to pass resolutions in support of the passage of H.R. 40 at the federal level. We've had resolutions pass, you know, in states like California and Louisiana. Chicago passed a resolution, different kinds of cities. We probably had about 100 states, cities, counties pass these kinds of resolutions. We've also had similar movement at the international level to actually support H.R. 40 type resolutions. Now, one of the things that you have to understand when you look at a bill like H.R. 40 is that it has very serious international consequences. When the United Nations had the World Conference on Racism, Xenophobia, and other forms of intolerance, reparations was one of the most divisive topics. It was probably one of the two most divisive topics, the other being the relationship between the Israeli government and the Palestinian community in the Middle East. You still have many countries internationally that do not want to address the whole issue of reparations because of the potential of longstanding legal liability as slavery being a violation of international law. So the United States has been very, very careful with respect to official positions that it's taken with respect to slavery and reparations. One of the things that we'll get into later when we talk about the passage of the Slavery Apology Bill is that that language was actually very divisive within itself. And there was a reason why it only passed the House, and there was a reason why it passed in the form and in the way that it did. But if you go back and you look at what happened at the UN conference in 2001, one of the things that happened in Durban was the fact that there was specific international law language that came about at that conference that said slavery was a crime against humanity and has always been so. That particular legal construction was very important, and it set former slave countries on edge, because it has the potential to create legal liability under international law. So when we start talking about the topic of reparations, when we start talking about the issue of apologies for slavery, it has serious legal issues today under international law. So when different countries get into these discussions, you will find that there's a great deal of detail with respect to crafting the language. There's a great deal of parsing with respect to the language, and there's a great deal of resistance with respect to movement on the issue. But I've kind of given you a little bit of an overview about where we started and how we've gotten to where we are right now, and we'll get to some of these issues in a little bit more detail later.
Something you had mentioned about the language, I just wanted to follow up on the last point, because part of the question I had asked was, why has H.R. 40 been unsuccessful while the apology was successful? If you look on the last page of the handout, I think probably some of the most important language is on the bottom of the page, the very last clause, resolved that the House of Representatives expresses its commitment to rectify the lingering consequences of misdeeds committed against African Americans under slavery and Jim Crow and to stop the occurrence of human rights violations in the future. You said there was a reason that it only passed in the House.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, there are a couple points to make with respect to this, and James, feel free to jump into this. I don't use the term success or failure with respect to legislation. Resolutions get passed, or they don't, or they get enacted, or they don't. To judge the success or failure of a statute or a resolution is more of a long-standing examination. I would think that on something like H.R. 40 or Mr. Cohen's slavery apology, it would take at least 5 years before you would be able to determine whether it was a success in terms of its passage. Now, one of the things that was going on here with H.R. 40 that I would say H.R. 40 has actually been a success, because what H.R. 40 has done year after year in terms of its enactment is to move the ball forward with respect to the discussion about slavery and Jim Crow. When I actually give formal speeches on H.R. 40, one of the things that I always say is that H.R. 40 runs smack in the face of the most serious myth of American history. The most serious myth of American history is that the Civil War was fought to free the slaves. Okay? The Civil War demonstrably was not fought to free the slaves. Okay? We have the same myth that we have to confront every time we have a debate around H.R. 40. This past year, last December, when we had the first hearing ever on H.R. 40, we had Steve King, who, did we defeat Steve King? We may have defeated Steve King.
No, we didn't.
We defeated Feeney. Sorry, no such luck. We had Steve King, who was a Republican member of Congress from Iowa, who said, well, I don't know why I would have to apologize because members of my family died in the Civil War. And the Civil War was fought to free the slaves. And you know, Mr. Conyers then, in his nice way, nods his head and gives this look like, man, what are you talking about? Okay, have you read any American history at all? And That's what we're really trying to get at with H.R. 40 is to actually sort of peel back the veil on this and look at American history for what it is. Because if you look at the fact that under the Johnson administration, there was a decision that was made to either redeem the South by selling out the freedmen or not. And the decision was made to actually sell out the freedmen, and that actually then allowed former officials from the Confederacy and slaveholders to come back in and essentially take over the state governments of southern states like Virginia. Okay, you saw an almost absolute end to enfranchisement and representation by African Americans at that point moving forward. So if anybody who thought that the Civil War was fought to actually yield real equality for African Americans was completely wrong, because the polity never acted like that moving forward. Okay. What James and I were looking at when we were crafting this whole thing is that what initially, well, James, why don't you tell everybody what the initial plan for the apology was and why and how that broke down.
Well, initially we wanted to, pass identical language, both House and Senate.
A concurrent resolution. And a concurrent resolution is signed by the President.
Has a force of law.
Right.
But then we hit this snag, and I guess Mike had earlier pointed out that language acknowledges that slavery is talked about rectifying harms in that resolve clause. Some people on the Senate side interpreted that to mean, this is the basis for reparations. And that scared a lot of folks on the Senate side. They wanted to include a disclaimer. Two things. initially, it came back and said, we would like to put this disclaimer language in that says, you have to say nothing in this resolution either supports or detracts from the idea of reparations. And then they tried to add, from their viewpoint as a sweetener, this crime against humanity language that Kingdom was talking about earlier. And so the Senate was crafting their version, and in their version of the resolution, it contained both this crime against humanity language and this disclaimer language. Initially, we were hesitant to go forward with the disclaimer language, period. At some point during the back and forth with the Senate, we sort of somewhat reached maybe not a comfort level, but we were like, maybe we can live with this idea. But we told them, actually, the White House and the executive branch generally, I think the DOJ also weighed in on it, would not be happy with this crimes against humanity language. And ultimately, that is what ended up happening, is that the president and I believe DOJ also voiced objections to that language. Then after that happened, we basically said, why not at least go ahead with the language that we had initially crafted and let the Senate do its thing.
The language in the Cohen bill is very progressive for a number of different reasons. The Cohen bill has language that addresses Jim Crow. The Senate resolution that was being offered did not address Jim Crow. And in an attempt to strike a balance between having a reparations disclaimer and not, they then went back in and put the crimes against humanity language in it, which we warned them about, and we said, this will actually create a bigger issue than your reparations disclaimer, because you can actually read the language of your resolution without the reparations disclaimer, and it's still fairly neutral. Because the issue of reparations was introduced into your resolution because of fear, not because of an affirmative legislative purpose. But when you then introduce the crimes against humanity language, you then introduce a question of legal liability that does not exist in either of the resolutions as drafted at the time. And we warned them about this. And they didn't believe us, But we said, well, okay, ultimately you're going to have to run this by DOJ, and DOJ reacted adversely to this because in 2001 at the Durban conference, that specific language in the Durban Declaration was one of the justifications that the United States used to actually leave the World Conference. So there was a disconnect between what the position was of the Bush administration at the time would be and what some of the Republican senators who were in fairly warm or lukewarm support of a resolution would have had at the time.
Will this administration be any different than the last one?
That's one of the things, that's one of the early transition issues that we have to deal with. The Durban Review Conference, Durban 2, takes place in March. There has been a carryover of the same concerns around Middle Eastern issues for the Durban Follow-On Conference as the original Durban Conference. And we have been trying through the passage of various resolutions of the House to ensure that whatever administration came in, now the Obama administration, would participate fully in the conference. And that's going to be one of the major transition issues because I was involved in the 2001 conference, and to the extent that we had success there, it was due to the fact that we had holdovers within the State Department still in during the early Bush administration handling some of the transition issues on this. The opposite can also be true with respect to holdovers from the Bush administration and the early Obama administration, so we're going to have to clear that out as quickly as we can. And we've already put that up as an agenda item for them.
Now, I'm just going to go ahead and read the next question I have. You two should feel free to do your best imitation of Sarah Palin and answer the question you want to answer rather than the question I'm asking, if that's what you prefer. But such as that is, Obama's impact on racial reconciliation. Will the legislative process play a role in racial reconciliation under an Obama administration? I noticed that in his speech on race, given early in the year after Reverend Wright tapes became the topic du jour in the media, he largely glossed over any racial grievances. Do you think we've entered a post-racial era, at least in terms of legislation? Could it be that truly progressive legislation will be implicitly targeted at the African American community? If so, is such covert legislation desirable? Has the long shadow of American racism been erased? If not, is it okay to pretend that it has if it allows us to better serve the economic interests of the African American community through legislation?
Okay, I will say this provocatively. No, we have not entered a post-racial America. If you look at
in terms of legislation,
right. I would say in any terms. If you look at the color of the electoral map, the South was still the South. And we picked up Virginia and North Carolina because of research triangle academic areas like Charlottesville and Northern Virginia in Virginia and the heavy Black Belt population that exists in the Richmond-Hampton Roads area. And the same thing is true of North Carolina. You've had out-migration of African Americans back to the South into North Carolina. And so those numbers in combination have been enough to elect Democrats and progressives, period. If you looked at what happened down in the rest of the South, it stayed red and it's going to stay that way until we get the same level of out-migration. Being even more provocative, if you look across the country, if you look at the Electoral College map that elected Obama, the scary, frightening thing about that is that with the exception of a handful of states that you could count on one hand, all of those states were actually won in the primaries by Hillary Clinton. So there was an interesting combination of a quirk of Democratic Party rules that allowed for a weighting of 50 states and the caucus process that allowed a tie between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama to go to Barack Obama, and states that stayed blue, states that were blue stayed blue. And given, you know, and we can talk about whatever social effects that we want, but, you know, quantitatively what's true is true, and that's true. With respect to the legislative process, Chairman Conyers would tell you that the problem that we've had is that social issues and social reactions have kept people from voting their pocketbook. So you've had lots of working class whites in red states not vote their pocketbook based upon social or racial issues. You know, and the interesting phrase that's been bandied about a lot is, you know, when your house is on fire, you don't care who your fireman is. I had a conversation with one of my colleagues yesterday who has a friend whose brother is an African-American firefighter. And he will tell you that he has come to the door of houses on fire and people won't let him in because he's black. So that truism isn't even true. And so for anybody who then believes that, you know, you got to go back and start thinking, you know, where do we start building here? Now, the fact of the matter is that, you know, the mortgage crisis is hitting everybody hard. It is disproportionately hitting African Americans in terms of numbers, but it's hitting a boatload of white Americans. Okay, I watched a Nightline special last night talking about a city in California where virtually all the mortgages there are upside down mortgages, and they, you know, highlighted a family that lost $500,000 of equity in their home in the last 2 years. The banks have told them, you just need to walk away because you will never get this money back. Okay? Now, that's happening all over the place. The issue then becomes, can everyone put down these social issues long enough to then enact a colorblind, economically focused agenda? Because if we actually enact that progressive agenda, it will hit everyone. And that's what John Conyers says. What I'm fighting for when I'm fighting for universal health care isn't just for black and brown people. It's for all people. Yeah, it affects a lot of black and brown people, but it affects everybody. When I'm trying to get jobs, justice and peace in place through my legislative agenda, it's not just for one people, it's for all the American people. So if we can actually get everybody to back up for a minute and slow down, then we may be able to get a progressive agenda in place. And, you know, the fact that, you know, President-elect Obama is where he is allows us to be very hopeful about all of this. Because forget about, you know, Obama's color. The fact of the matter is, is that we have never, ever elected a Democrat from the progressive wing of our party to the White House. That has never happened. Okay, that is the most historic thing that we can look at. That was the difference between Barack Obama, between electing Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was the definition of centrist. Barack Obama had to drift back to the center, but Barack Obama was unquestionably from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And that is why, one of the reasons why Congressman Conyers was so enthusiastic in supporting him. Because the whole idea of getting a progressive into the White House makes our job much more straightforward than it has ever been in his 40 plus years in Congress.
I wanted to just follow up a little bit on that, because it sounded like to me what you were saying was that, you know, your boss is saying if we lift everybody's economic boat, we're all better off. But in order to do that, in order to get past the social issues, somehow we have to put on the blinders and disregard this nation's race history.
No, he wouldn't agree with that. And that's one of the important parts about H.R. 40 and the slavery apology. Unless you actually confront the reality with which you are faced, you can't put fair policies in place. I mean, if you're actually missing a whole sort of branch of your causality tree, how are you possibly going to actually reach a root cause, the correct root cause, and put, you know, legislation in place? You can't do it. So, you know, he would not, you know, say that you need to be, you know, that myopic in your view. You have to be able to still call him as you see him when you're looking at these issues.
The last question we're going to have time for, because I want to save time for questions from you folks. Is the reason we're here today is I'm taking a class with Professor Ford Mazrui, Advanced Race and Law Projects. In my project, the idea I had was to introduce some sort of legislation to amend the United States Constitution. There's three sections in the Constitution that are all but explicitly calling out slavery. You've got the Three-Fifths Clause, which allowed the South to retain more political power than they probably deserved based on their slave ownership. The Fugitive Slave Clause, which required every state to respect the slavery laws of another state, so you had to return property, in other words, slaves. And the third issue was the 20-year clause that allowed that prohibited the Constitution from being amended to restrict the importation of slaves for 20 years after its founding. Now, the Constitution's been the Constitution forever. I've read some books on the subject. I've never seen, there have been thousands and I think every year there's like 10,000 amendments proposed. I've never seen the Constitution proposed to fix that, and I just can't imagine what it would be like to be a seventh grade African American boy or girl and in your civics class be confronted with this. I just want to know why it was still there. So my idea for the amendment, it's a lot harder than it turns out to craft language, because I'm taking something out of the Constitution rather than adding something at the end of it. But I wanted to know what you folks thought about the entire idea, and I was hoping you could speak to it a little bit.
Honestly, it's probably something that my boss would be interested in exploring. Knowing my boss, and he has introduced some constitutional amendments in his short time in the House. Certainly, I mean, this is kind of fits in with what I was talking about. His impetus behind slavery, introducing slavery apology, is would also fit in with that. Say, well, before you can move forward, you need to address this past legacy, slavery, of racism against African Americans. Actually, I think, realistically, I don't know how far you can go. But I think the reasonable case, more than a reasonable case, can be made for passing such an amendment. But we would still run into a lot of the social barriers that Keenan was talking about, politically speaking. You have to get X number of states to adopt the resolution, adopt the amendment to the Constitution.
What would the arguments be against it?
Well, this has happened, as you are probably well aware, that rescission-type amendments have come up on state referenda. In Alabama, they had a lot of it goes to, anti-miscegenation language in various state constitutions, as I know that I've been speaking in Virginia now. In Alabama, I think, what was it, last cycle, 2 years ago, they had a rescission referendum come up, and it failed. So, I mean, the issue isn't on the merits. The issue is really going to be the political atmospherics. And, I think it would be fascinating to see what would happen if you did a Three-Fifths Clause rescission amendment, just to see what people would say. Because then what you would have to do to actually debate this is to do the same thing that Chairman Conyers is talking about around H.R. 40. You would actually have to have a national discussion about why that was there in the first place. Same thing with Fugitive Slave Act clauses. And for most people, they would rather do anything than to have a discussion that highlights the fact that our sacred founding document is tainted in that way. I mean,
and even with the slavery apology, I kind of had the same initial reaction. Was, well, this seems pretty reasonable that Congress should apologize for this. I don't think anyone would stand up and defend the practice of slavery or Jim Crow, and yet. It came up, there was a reparations issue, but I also do think, and kind of touching on what Keenan was saying, that there was just this sense that nobody wants to talk about it. So just the mere fact of introducing the apology kind of stirred up a bit of a hornet's nest. And, you know, people said, well, they're concerned about reparations, and I'm sure that was part of it, but I think that was also kind of a cover for saying, well, I just don't want to talk about it, period. You know, the most common response we would always get was, well, I prefer to think about the future instead of the past, so let's just think about the future.
And remember that you have to look procedurally at the way that the resolution was passed. The resolution was passed under the suspension of rules and was passed by a voice vote.
And the interesting thing about that was initially, and I don't remember exactly why, but the Republicans had been raising points of order because there was an absence of a quorum. And they were doing that for every bill that was on suspension that day.
Drill. This is when they were still debating. drill offshore drilling expansion.
So, and yet, apparently, and it was Steve King who was managing time on the Republican side during the debate on the slavery resolution. I didn't even realize it. He came back kind of right before recorded votes were to take place around 6:30 at night. Kind of almost, had this very middle of the night feel. He just kind of came back, didn't tell him. My boss wasn't aware.
Because we were on the floor.
Right, and he just said, all right, I withdraw my point of order, and then they just went ahead and passed it by voice vote, but you would never have known.
They were afraid to death of having to come in and have a recorded vote on that.
Right.
Because he asked for a recorded vote, and when we were debating it, and we looked at each other and said, what? And we're like, hey, fine. Right. We love this. And we didn't ask for it. You asked for it. That's great for us. And then when we came back, it was the, oh, yeah, by the way, that's been
passed.
So okay. You can just go home. Otherwise, you know, I could have gone home and had dinner at a reasonable hour. But, you know, there's that much fear around having to take an open position on these kinds of issues.